Yes, sir. But he is obviously taken by surprise. Under Tadaaki's cold stare, his own eyes drop to the floor. Stand up! Yes, sir, he said without rising. Stand up! This instant! Toranosuke rose to his feet. The others looked on mutely. I'm expelling you from the school. He paused to let this sink in. But in doing so, I hope there will come a day when you'll have mended your ways, learned discipline, and grasped the meaning of the art of war. Perhaps at that time, we can be together again as teacher and student. Now get out!
Master, why? I don't remember doing anything to deserve this.
You don't remember because you don't understand the art of war. If you think about it long and carefully, you'll see.
Tell me, please. I can't leave until you do.
The veins stood out on his forehead.
All right. Cowardice is the most shameful weakness a samurai can be accused of. The art of war admonishes strictly against it. It is an ironclad rule at this school that any man guilty of a cowardly act must be expelled. Nevertheless, you, Hamada Toranosuke, let several weeks pass after your brother's death before challenging Sasaki Kojiro. In the meantime, you ran around trying to take revenge on some insignificant melon vendor. And yesterday, you took this man's aged mother captive and brought her here. Do you call that conduct becoming a samurai?
But, sir, you don't understand. I did it to draw Kojiro out.
He was about to launch into a spirited defense, but Tadaaki cut him short.
That's precisely what I mean by cowardice. If you wanted to fight Kojiro, why didn't you go directly to his house? Why didn't you send him a message challenging him? Why didn't you declare your name and your purpose?
Well, I did consider those things, but...
Consider? There was nothing to stop you from doing that. But you adopted the cowardly ruse of getting others to help you lure Kojiro here so you could attack him en masse. By comparison, Kojiro's attitude was admirable.
Tadaaki paused.
He came alone, to see me personally. Refusing to have anything to do with a coward, he challenged me, on the grounds that a student's misconduct is his teacher's misconduct. The result of the confrontation between his sword and mine revealed a shameful crime. I now humbly confess that crime.
The room was deathly quiet.
Now, Toranosuke, upon reflection, do you still believe yourself to be a samurai without shame?
Forgive me.
Get out!
Eyes downcast, Toranosuke walked back 10 paces and knelt on the floor with his arms before him, preparatory to bowing.
I wish you the best of health, sir. And the same to the rest of you.
His voice was dark. He rose and walked sadly from the dojo. Tadaaki stood up.
I, too, must take my leave of the world.
Suppressed sobs were audible. His final words were stern, yet full of affection.
Why mourn? Your day has come. It's up to you to see that the school advances into a new age with honor. Beginning now, be humble, work hard, and try with all your might to cultivate your spirit.
Returning to the guest room, Tadaaki appeared quite unperturbed as he quietly took a seat and addressed Kojiro. After apologizing for keeping him waiting, he said,
I've just expelled Hamada. I advised him to change his ways, to try to understand the real meaning of the samurai's discipline. I intend, of course, to release the old woman. Would you like to take her back with you, or should I arrange for her to go later?
Unsatisfied with what you've done, she can go with me,
Kojiro moved as though to rise. The bout had completely drained him, and the subsequent wait had seemed very, very long.
"Don't go yet," said Tadaki. "Now that it's all over, let's have a cup together and let bygones be bygones."
Clapping his hands, he called, "Omitsu, bring some sake."
"Thank you," said Kojiro. "It's kind of you to ask me."
He smiled and said hypocritically, "I know now why Ono Tadaaki and the Itto style are so famous." He had no respect whatsoever for Tadaaki.
"If his natural talents are developed in the right way," thought Tadaaki, "the world will bow at his feet. But if he takes the wrong turn, there's another Zenki in the making." "If you were my student..."
The words were on the tip of Tadaki's tongue. Instead of saying them, he laughed and replied modestly to Kojiro's flattery. In the course of their conversation, Musashi's name came up, and Kojiro learned he was under consideration to become one of the selected group of men who gave lessons to the shogun. Kojiro merely said, "Oh?" But his expression betrayed his displeasure. Turning his eyes quickly toward the setting sun, he insisted it was time for him to go. Not many days after that, Tadaaki vanished from Edo. He had the reputation of being a simple, straightforward warrior, the embodiment of honesty and selflessness, but a man who lacked Munenori's knack for politics. Not understanding why a man who could apparently accomplish anything he set his mind to would flee the world, people were consumed with curiosity and read all sorts of meanings into his disappearance. As a result of his failure, Tadaaki, it was said, had lost his mind. The Poignancy of Things. Musashi said it was the worst storm he'd ever seen. Iori gazed wistfully at the sodden, tattered book pages scattered hither and yon, and thought sadly, "No more studying." 2 days of autumn, the 210th and 220th days of the year, were especially dreaded by farmers. It was on these 2 days that typhoons were most likely to destroy the rice crop. Iori, more attuned to the dangers than his master, had taken the precaution of tying down the roof and weighing it with rocks. Nevertheless, during the night, the wind had ripped the roof off, and when it was light enough to inspect the damage, it was evident that the cabin was beyond any hope of repair. With his experience at Hotengahara in mind, Musashi set off shortly after dawn. Watching him go, Iori thought, "What good will it do him to look at the neighbors' paddies? Of course they're flooded. Doesn't his own house mean anything to him?" He built a fire, using bits and pieces of the walls and floor, and roasted some chestnuts and dead birds for breakfast. The smoke stung his eyes. Musashi came back a little after noon. About an hour later, a group of farmers wearing thick straw rain capes arrived to offer their thanks for assistance to a sick person, for help in draining off the flood water, for a number of other services. As one old man admitted, "We always get into quarrels at times like these, what with everybody in a hurry to take care of his own problems first. But today, we followed your advice and worked together." They also brought gifts of food, sweets, pickles, and, to Iori's delight, rice cakes. As he thought about it, Iori decided that that day he'd learned a lesson. If one forgot about oneself and worked for the group, food would naturally be forthcoming.
"We'll build you a new house," one farmer promised. "One that won't be blown down."
For the present, he invited them to stay at his house, the oldest in the village. When they got there, the man's wife hung their clothes out to dry, and when they were ready to go to bed, they were shown to separate rooms. Before he fell asleep, Iori became aware of a sound that stirred his interest. Turning over to face Musashi's room, he whispered through the shoji,
"Do you hear that, sir?"
"Mm."
"Listen, you can just hear them. Drums from the shrine dances. Strange, isn't it? Having religious dances the night after a typhoon."
The only reply was the sound of deep breathing. The next morning, Iori got up early and asked the farmer about the drums. Coming back to Musashi's room, he said brightly,
"Mitsumine Shrine in Chichibu isn't so far from here, is it?"
"I shouldn't think so."
"I wish you'd take me there, to pay my respects."
Puzzled, Musashi asked why the sudden interest and was told that the drummers had been musicians in a neighboring village, practicing for the Asagaya sacred dance, which their household had specialized in since the distant past. They went every month to perform at the Mitsumine Shrine Festival. The beauty of music and the dance was known to Iori only through these Shinto dances. He was inordinately fond of them, and having heard that the Mitsumine dances were one of the three great types in this tradition, he had his heart set on seeing them.
"Won't you take me?" he pleaded. "It'll be 5 or 6 days at least before our house is ready."
Iori's fervency reminded Musashi of Jotaro, who had often made a nuisance of himself, whining, pouting, purring to get what he wanted. Iori, so grown up and self-sufficient for his age, rarely resorted to such tactics. Musashi wasn't thinking about it particularly, but an observer might have noticed the effects of his influence. One thing he had deliberately taught Iori was to make a strict distinction between himself and his teacher. At first, he replied noncommittally, but after a little thought, he said,
"All right, I'll take you."
Iori jumped in the air, exclaiming,
"The weather's good, too!"
Within 5 minutes, he'd reported his good fortune to their host, requested box lunches, and procured new straw sandals. Then he was in front of his teacher again, asking,
"Shouldn't we get started?"
The farmer saw them off with the promise that their house would be finished by the time they returned. They passed places where the typhoon had left ponds, small lakes almost, in its wake. But otherwise, it was difficult to believe the heavens had unleashed their fury only 2 days earlier. Shrikes flew low in the clear blue sky. The first night, they chose a cheap inn in the village of Tanashi and went to bed early. The next day, their road led them farther into the great Musashino Plain. Their journey was interrupted for several hours at the Iruma River, which was swollen to 3 times its normal size. Only a short section of the dirt bridge stood, uselessly, in the middle of the stream. While Musashi watched a group of farmers carrying new piling out from both sides to make a temporary crossing, Iori noticed some old arrowheads and remarked on them, adding,
"There's tops of helmets, too. There must have been a battle here."
He amused himself along the riverbank, digging up arrowheads, rusted fragments of broken swords, and miscellaneous pieces of old, unidentifiable metal. Suddenly, he snatched his hand away from a white object he'd been about to pick up.
"It's a human bone!" he cried.
"Bring it over here," said Musashi.
Iori had no stomach for touching it again.
"What are you going to do with it?"
"Bury it where it won't be walked on."
"It's not just a couple of bones. There's lots of them."
"Good. It'll give us something to do. Bring all you can find."
Turning his back to the river, he said,
"You can bury them over there, where those gentians are blooming."
"I don't have a spade."
"You can use a broken sword."
When the hole was deep enough, Iori put the bones in it, then gathered up his collection of arrowheads and bits of metal and buried them with the bones.
"Is that all right?"
he asked.
"Put some rocks over it. Make it into a proper memorial."
"When was there a battle here?"
"Have you forgotten? You must have read about it. The Taiheiki tells about two fierce battles in 1333 and 1352 in a place called Kotesashigahara. That's about where we are now. On one side was the Nitta family, supporting the southern court, and on the other, a huge army led by Ashikaga Takauji."
"Oh, the battles of Kotesashigahara. I remember now."
At Musashi's urging, Iori continued, "The book tells us Prince Munenaga lived in the eastern region for a long time and studied the way of the samurai, but was astonished when the emperor appointed him shogun."
"What was the poem he composed on that occasion?" Musashi asked.
Iori glanced up at a bird soaring through the azure sky and recited, "How could I have known I'd ever be master of the Catalpa bow? Had I not passed through life without touching it?"
"And the poem in the chapter telling how he crossed into Musashi Province and fought at Kotesashigahara?"
The boy hesitated, biting his lip, then began in phrasing largely of his own making. "Why, then, should I cling to a life that is fullified, when nobly given for the sake of our great lord, for the sake of the people?"
"And the meaning?"
"I understand that."
"Are you sure?"
"Anyone who can't understand without having it explained to him isn't really Japanese, even if he is a samurai. Isn't that true?"
"Yes. But tell me, Iori, if that's the case, why are you behaving as though handling those bones made your hands dirty?"
"Would it make you feel good to handle the bones of dead people?"
"The men who died here were soldiers. They'd fought and perished for the sentiments expressed in Prince Munenaga's poem. The number of samurai like that is uncountable. Their bones, buried in the earth, are the foundation on which this country is built. Were it not for them, we'd still have neither peace nor the prospect of prosperity. Wars, like the typhoon we had, pass. The land as a whole is unchanged, but we must never forget the debt we owe to the white bones under the ground."
Iori nodded at almost every word. "I understand now. Shall I make an offering of flowers and bow before the bones I buried?"
Musashi laughed. "Bowing's not really necessary, if you keep the memory alive in your heart."
"But..." Not quite satisfied, the boy picked some flowers and placed them before the pile of stones. He was about to clasp his hands together in obeisance when another troubling thought came to him. "Sir, it's all well and good if these bones really belong to samurai who were loyal to the emperor, but what if they're the remains of Ashikaga Takauji's men? I wouldn't want to pay respect to them." Iori stared at him, waiting for his answer. Musashi fixed his eyes on the thin sliver of daylight moon, but no satisfactory reply came to mind. At length he said, "In Buddhism, there is salvation even for those guilty of the 10 evils and the 5 deadly sins. The heart itself is enlightenment. The Buddha forgives the wicked if only they'll open their eyes to his wisdom. Does that mean loyal warriors and evil rebels are the same after they die?"
"No," Musashi said emphatically.
"A samurai holds his name to be sacred. If he sullies it, there's no redress throughout all generations." "Then why does the Buddha treat bad people and loyal servants alike?"
"Because people are all fundamentally the same. There are those who are so blinded by self-interest and desire that they become rebels or brigands. The Buddha is willing to overlook this. He urges all to accept enlightenment, to open their eyes to true wisdom. This is the message of 1,000 scriptures. Of course, when one dies, all becomes void."
"I see," said Iori, without really seeing.
He pondered the matter for a few minutes and then asked,
"But that's not true of samurai, is it? Not everything becomes void when a samurai dies."
"Why do you say that?"
"His name lives on, doesn't it?"
"That's true."
"If it's a bad name, it stays bad. If it's a good name, it stays good, even when the samurai is reduced to bones. Isn't that the way it is?"
"Yes, but it isn't really quite so simple," said Musashi, wondering if he could successfully guide his pupil's curiosity. "In the case of a samurai, there is such a thing as an appreciation of the poignancy of things.
A warrior lacking this sensitivity is like a shrub in a desert. To be a strong fighter and nothing more is to be like a typhoon. It's the same with swordsmen who think of nothing but swords, swords, swords. A real samurai, a genuine swordsman, has a compassionate heart. He understands the poignancy of life. Silently, Iori rearranged the flowers and clasped his hands. Two drumsticks. Halfway up the mountain, ant-like human figures, climbing in continual procession, were swallowed up by a thick ring of clouds. Emerging near the summit, where Mitsumine Shrine was situated, they were greeted by a cloudless sky. The mountain's three peaks, Kumotori, Shiraiwa, and Myōhōgatake, straddled four eastern provinces. Within the Shinto complex, there were Buddhist temples, pagodas, various other buildings and gates. Outside was a flourishing little town with tea houses and souvenir shops, the offices of the high priests and the houses of some 70 farmers whose produce was reserved for the shrine's use.
"Listen, they've started playing the big drums,"
Iori said excitedly, gobbling down his rice and red beans. Musashi sat opposite, enjoying his repast at a leisurely pace. Iori threw down his chopsticks.
"The music started," he said. "Let's go and watch."
"I had enough last night. You go alone."
"But they only did two dances last night. Don't you want to see the others?"
"Not if it means hurrying."
Seeing his master's wooden bowl was still half full, Iori said in a calmer tone,
"Thousands of people have arrived since yesterday. It'd be a shame if it rained."
"Oh?" When Musashi finally said, "Shall we go now?"
Iori bounded for the front door like a dog unleashed, borrowed some straw sandals, and set them in place on the doorstep for his master. In front of the Kannon-in, the sub-temple where they were staying, and on both sides of the shrine's main gate, great bonfires blazed. Every house had a lighted torch in front of it, and the whole area, several thousand feet above sea level, was as bright as day. Overhead, in a sky the color of a deep lake, the river of heaven glittered like magic smoke, while in the street swarms of men and women, oblivious of the chill in the mountain air, surged toward the stage where the sacred dances were performed. Flutes and great drums echoed on the mountain breeze. The stage itself was empty, except for the gently fluttering banners that would soon serve as a backdrop. Jostled by the mob, Iori got separated from Musashi, but quickly pushed his way through the crowd until he spied him standing near a building, staring up at a list of donors. Iori called his name, ran up to him, tugged at his sleeve, but Musashi's attention was riveted on one plaque, larger than the others. It stood out from all the rest because of the size of the contribution made by Daizo of Narai, Shibaura Village, Province of Musashi. The booming of the drums built to a crescendo.
"They've started the dance!" squealed Iori,
his heart flying to the sacred dance pavilion.
"Sensei, what are you looking at?"
Musashi, stirred from his reverie, said,
"Oh, nothing special. I just remembered something I have to do. You go watch the dances. I'll be along later."
Musashi sought out the office of the Shinto priests, where he was greeted by an old man.
"I'd like to inquire about a donor," said Musashi.
"Sorry, we don't have anything to do with that here. You'll have to go to the residence of the chief Buddhist priest. I'll show you where it is."
Though Mitsumine Shrine was Shinto, general supervision of the whole establishment was in the hands of a Buddhist prelate. The plaque over the gate read, "Office of the High Priest in Charge," in suitably large characters. At the entrance hall, the old man talked at some length with the priest on duty. When they were finished, the priest invited Musashi inside and very politely led him to an inner room. Tea was served, along with a tray of splendid cakes. Next came a second tray, followed shortly by a handsome young acolyte bearing sake. Presently, no less a personage than a provisional bishop appeared.
"Welcome to our mountain," he said. "I fear we have only simple country fare to offer you. I trust you'll forgive us. Please, make yourself comfortable."
Musashi was at a loss to understand the solicitous treatment. Without touching the sake, he said, "I came to make an inquiry about one of your donors."
"What?"
The benign countenance of the priest, a rotund man of about 50, underwent a subtle alteration.
"An inquiry?"
he asked suspiciously. In rapid succession, Musashi asked when Daizo had come to the temple, whether he came there often, whether he ever brought anyone with him, and if so, what sort of person. With every question, the priest's displeasure grew, until finally he said,
"Then you're not here to make a contribution, but merely to ask questions about someone who did?"
His face was a study in exasperation.
"The old man must have misunderstood me. I never intended to make a donation. I only wanted to ask about Daizo."
"You could have made that perfectly clear at the entrance," the priest said haughtily.
"From all I can see, you're a ronin. I don't know who you are or where you come from. You must understand that I can't give out information about our donors to just anyone."
"I assure you, nothing will happen."
"Well, you'll have to see the priest in charge of such matters."
Looking as though he felt he'd been robbed, he dismissed Musashi.
The register of contributors turned out to be no more helpful, for it recorded only that Daizo had been there several times. Musashi thanked the priest and left.
Near the dance pavilion, he looked around for Iori without seeing him. If he'd looked up, he would have. The boy was almost directly over his head, having climbed a tree to get a better view. Watching the scene unfolding on the stage, Musashi was transported back to his childhood, to the night festivals at the Sanumo Shrine in Miyamoto. He saw phantom images of the crowds, of Otsu's white face in their midst, of Matahachi always chewing food, of Uncle Gong walking about importantly. Vaguely, he sensed the face of his mother, worried about his being out so late, coming to look for him. The musicians, clad in usual costumes intended to simulate the elegance of the imperial guards of old, took their places on the stage. In the light of the fire, their tawdry finery, glittering with patches of gold brocade, was suggestive of the mythical robes of the age of the gods. The beating of the slightly slack drumheads reverberated through the forest of Cryptomeria, then the flutes and well-seasoned boards clapped rhythmically with small blocks, sounded the prelude. The master of the dance came forward, wearing the mask of an ancient man. This unearthly face, from whose cheeks and chin much of the lacquer had peeled, moved slowly as he sang the words of Kamiyasobi, the dance of the gods. On sacred Mount Mimuro, with its goldly fence, before the great deity, the leaves of the sakaki tree grow in profuse abundance, grow in profuse abundance. The tempo of the drums picked up, and other instruments joined in. Soon, song and dance melded in a lively syncopated rhythm. Whence came the spear? It is the spear of the sacred dwelling, of the princess Toyooka, who is in heaven. The spear of the sacred dwelling. Musashi knew some of the songs. As a child, he had sung them and donned a mask and taken part in the dancing at Sanumo Shrine. The sword that protects the people of all lands. Let's hang it festively before the deity. Hang it festively before the deity. The revelation struck like lightning. Musashi had been watching the hands of one of the drummers, wielding two short, club-shaped drumsticks. He sucked in his breath and fairly shouted, "That's it! Two swords!" startled by the voice, Iori took his eyes away from the stage just long enough to look down and say, "Oh, there you are!" Musashi didn't even glance up. He stared straight ahead, not in dreamy rapture like the others, but with a look of almost frightening penetration.
"Two swords," he repeated. "It's the same principle. Two drumsticks, but only one sound."
He folded his arms more tightly and scrutinized the drummer's every movement. From one point of view, it was simplicity itself. People were born with two hands. Why not use both of them? As it was, swordsmen fought with only one sword and often one hand. This made sense, so long as everybody followed the same practice. But if one combatant were to employ two swords at once, what chance would an opponent using only one have of winning? Against the Yoshioka school at Ichijoji, Musashi had discovered his long sword in his right hand, his short sword in his left. He had grasped both weapons instinctively, unconsciously, each arm involved to the utmost in protecting him. In a life-and-death struggle, he had reacted in an unorthodox fashion. Now, all of a sudden, the rationale seemed natural, if not inevitable. If two armies were facing each other in battle, it would be unthinkable under the rules of the art of war for either to make use of one flank while allowing the other to stand idle. Was there not a principle here that the lone swordsman could not afford to ignore? Ever since Ichijoji, it had seemed to Musashi that to use both hands and both swords was the normal human way. Only custom, followed unquestioningly over the centuries, had made it seem abnormal. He felt he had arrived at an undeniable truth. Custom had made the unnatural appear natural, and vice versa. While custom was bred by daily experience, being on the boundary between life and death was something that occurred only a few times during a lifetime. Yet the ultimate aim of the Way of the Sword was to be able to stand on the brink of death at any time. Facing death squarely, unflinchingly, should be as familiar as all other daily experiences. And the process had to be a conscious one, though movement should be as free as if it were purely reflexive. The two-sword style had to be of this nature, conscious but at the same time as automatic as a reflex, completely free of the restrictions inherent in conscious action. Musashi had been trying for some time to unite in a valid principle what he knew instinctively with what he had learned by intellectual means. Now he was close to formulating it in words, and it would make him famous throughout the country for generations to come. Two drumsticks, one sound. The drummer was conscious of left and right, right and left, but at the same time unconscious of them. Here, before his eyes, was the Buddhist sphere of free interpenetration. Musashi felt enlightened, fulfilled. The five sacred dances, having begun with the song of the master of the dance, continued with performances by the dancers. There was the broad, sweeping dance of Iwato, then the dance of Aramikoto no Hoko. The melodies of the flutes quickened, bells rang in lively rhythm. Musashi looked up at Iori and said, "Aren't you ready to leave?"
"Not yet,"
came the absent-minded reply. Iori's spirit had become part of the dance. He felt himself to be one of the performers.
"Come back before it gets too late. Tomorrow we're going to climb the peak to the inner shrine."
The Demon's Attendant. The dogs of Mitsumine were a feral breed, said to result from the crossing of dogs brought by immigrants from Korea more than 1,000 years earlier with the wild dogs of the Chichibu Mountains. Only a step removed from the wild stage, They roamed the mountainside and fed like wolves on the other wildlife in the region. But since they were regarded as messengers of the deity and were spoken of as his attendants, worshippers often took home printed or sculptured images of them as good luck charms. The black dog with the man following Musashi was the size of a calf. As Musashi entered the Kannon-in, the man turned, said, "This way," and beckoned with his free hand. The dog growled, tugging at his leash, a piece of thick rope, and began sniffing. Flicking the leash across the dog's back, the man said, "Shh,
Guro, be quiet."
The man was about 50, solidly but supplely built, and like his dog, he seemed not quite tame. But he was well-dressed. With his kimono, which looked like a priest's robe or a samurai's formal wear, he wore a narrow, flat obi and a hemp hakama. His straw sandals, of the sort men wore at festivals, were fitted with new thongs.
"Baikeng?"
The woman held back to keep away from the dog.
"Down,"
commanded Baikeng, rapping the animal sharply on the head.
"I'm glad you spotted him, Oko."
"Then it was him?"
"No doubt about it."
For a moment, they stood silently looking through a break in the clouds at the stars, hearing but not really listening to the sacred dance music.
"What'll we do?"
she asked.
"I'll think of something."
"We can't let this chance go to waste."
Oko stared expectantly at Baikan.
"Is Toji at home?"
he asked.
"Yes. He got drunk on the festival sake and fell asleep."
"Get him up."
"What about you?"
"I've got work to do. After I make my rounds, I'll come to your place."
Outside the main shrine gate, Oko broke into a trot. Most of the 20 or 30 houses were souvenir shops or tea houses. There were also a few small eating establishments, from which emanated the cheerful voices of revelers. From the eaves of the shack Oko entered hung a sign saying, "Rest House." On one of the stools in the dirt-floored front room sat a young servant enjoying a catnap.
"Still sleeping?"
asked Oko. The girl, expecting a scolding, shook her head vigorously.
"I don't mean you, my husband."
"Oh, yes, he's still asleep."
With a disapproving click of her tongue, Oko grumbled.
"A festival's going on and he's sleeping. This is the only shop that isn't full of customers."
Near the door, a man and an old woman were steaming rice and beans in an earthen oven. The flames struck the only cheerful note in the otherwise gloomy interior. Oko walked over to where a man was sleeping on a bench by the wall, tapped him on the shoulder and said,
"Get up, you! Open your eyes for a change!"
"Huh?"
he mumbled, raising himself slightly.
"Oh my!"
she exclaimed as she backed away. Then she laughed and said,
"I'm sorry. I thought you were my husband."
A piece of matting had slipped to the ground. The man, a round-faced youth with large, questioning eyes, picked it up, pulled it over his face, and stretched out again. His head rested on a wooden pillow and his sandals were spattered with mud. On the table next to him were a tray and an empty rice bowl, by the wall a travel pack, a basket hat, and a staff. Turning back to the girl, Oko said,
"I suppose he's a customer?"
"Yes. He said he's planning to go up to the inner shrine early in the morning and asked if it was all right to take a nap here."
"Where's Toji?"
"I'm over here, stupid."
His voice came from behind a torn shoji. Reclining in the next room, with one foot hanging out into the shop, he said sullenly,
"And why carry on about me taking a little snooze? Where have you been all this time, when you should have been tending to business?"
In many ways, the years had been even less kind to Oko than they had to Toji. Not only was the charm of her earlier years no longer evident, but running the Oinu tea house required her to do a man's work to make up for her shiftless spouse, since Toji made a pittance hunting in the winter but did little else.
After Musashi burned down their hideout with its trick room at Wada Pass, their henchmen had all deserted them. Toji's bleary red eyes gradually focused on a barrel of water. Pulling himself to his feet, he went over to it and gulped down a dipperful. Oko leaned on a bench and looked over her shoulder at him. "I don't care if there is a festival going on. It's about time you learned when to stop. You're lucky you didn't get run through by a sword while you were out."
"Huh?
I'm telling you, you'd better be more careful."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Did you know Musashi's here at the festival?"
"Musashi? Miyamoto Musashi?"
Jolted into wakefulness, he said,
"Are you serious? Look, you'd better go hide in the back."
"Is that all you can think of? Hiding?
I don't want what happened at Wada Pass to happen again."
"Coward. Aren't you eager to get even with him, not only for that, but for what he did to the Yoshioka school? I am, and I'm only a woman."
"Yeah, but don't forget, we had lots of men to help us then. Now there's just the two of us."
Toji hadn't been at Ichijoji, but he had heard how Musashi had fought, and had no illusions about who would end up dead if the two of them ran into each other again. Sidling up to her husband, Oko said, "That's where you're wrong. There's another man here, isn't there? A man who hates Musashi as much as you do?"
Toji knew she was referring to Baiken, whom they had become acquainted with when their wanderings brought them to Mitsumine. Since there were no more battles, being a freebooter was no longer profitable, so Baiken had opened a smithy in Iga, only to be driven out when Lord Todo tightened his rule over the province. Intending to seek his fortune in Edo, he had disbanded his gang, but then, through the introduction of a friend, had become the watchman at the temple's treasure house. Even now, the mountains between the provinces of Musashi and Kai were infested with bandits. In hiring Baiken to guard the treasure house with its religious treasures and donated cash, the temple elders were fighting fire with fire. He had the advantage of being intimately familiar with the ways of bandits, and he was also an acknowledged expert with the chain ball sickle. As the originator of the Yaegaki style, he might possibly have attracted the attention of a daimyo, had it not been for the fact that his brother was Tsujikaze Tenma. In years long past, the two of them had terrorized the region between Mount Ibuki and the Yasugawa district. Changing times meant nothing to Baiken. To his way of thinking, Tenma's death at the hands of Takezo had been the ultimate cause of all his subsequent difficulties. Oko had long since told Baiken about their grievance against Musashi, exaggerating her rancor in order to cement her friendship with him. He had responded by scowling and saying,
"One of these days."
Oko had just finished telling Toji how she had caught sight of Musashi from the tea house, then lost him in the crowd. Later, on a hunch, she had gone to the Kannon-in, arriving just as Musashi and Iori were leaving for the outer shrine. This information she had promptly imparted to Baiken.
"So that's the way it is," said Toji,
taking courage from the knowledge that a dependable ally had already been lined up. He knew Baiken, using his favorite weapon, had beaten every swordsman at the recent shrine tournament. If he attacked Musashi, there was a good chance of winning.
"What did he say when you told him?"
"He'll come as soon as he finishes his rounds."
"Musashi's no fool. If we're not careful..."
Toji shuddered and uttered a gruff, unintelligible sound. Oko followed his eyes to the man sleeping on the bench.
"Who's that?"
asked Toji.
"Just a customer," answered Oko.
"Wake him up and get him out of here."
Oko delegated this task to the girl's servant, who went to the far corner and shook the man until he sat up.
"Get out," she said bluntly. "We're closing up now."
He stood up, stretched, and said,
"That was a nice nap."
Smiling to himself and blinking his large eyes, he moved quickly but smoothly, wrapping the matting around his shoulders, donning his basket hat, and adjusting his pack. He placed his staff under his arm, said,
Thanks a lot,
with a bow, and walked quickly out the door. Okor judged from his clothing and accent that he was not one of the local farmers, but he seemed harmless enough.
Funny-looking man, she said. I wonder if he paid his bill.
Oko and Toji were still rolling up blinds and straightening up the shop when Baiken came in with Kuro.
Good to see you, said Toji. Let's go to the back room.
Baiken silently removed his sandals and followed them, while the dog nosed around for scraps of food. The back room was only a broken-down lean-to with the first coat of rough plaster on the walls. It was out of earshot of anyone in the shop. When a lamp had been lit, Baiken said,
"This evening, in front of the dance stage, I overheard Musashi tell the boy they'd go up to the inner shrine tomorrow morning. Later, I went to the Kannonin and checked it out."
Both Oko and Toji swallowed and looked out the window. The peak on which the inner shrine stood was dimly outlined against the starry sky. Knowing whom he was up against, Baiken had made a plan of attack and mobilized reinforcements. Two priests, guards at the treasure house, had already agreed to help and had gone on ahead with their lances. There was also a man from the Yoshioka school who ran a small dojo at the shrine. Baiken calculated he could mobilize perhaps 10 freebooters, men he'd known in Iga who were now working in the vicinity. Toji would carry a musket, while Baiken would have his chainball sickle.
"You've done all this already?" asked Toji in disbelief.
Baiken grinned, but said nothing more. A diminutive sliver of moon hung high above the valley, hidden from view by a thick fog. The great peak was still sleeping, with only the gurgling and roaring of the river to accentuate the silence. A group of dark figures huddled on the bridge at Kosaruzawa.
"Toji,"
Baiken whispered hoarsely.
"Here, be sure to keep your fuse dry."
Conspicuous among the motley crew were the two lancer priests, who had the skirts of their robes tucked up ready for action. The others were dressed in a variety of outfits, but all were shod so as to be able to move nimbly.
"Is this everybody?"
"Yes."
"How many altogether?"
They counted heads. 13.
"Good," said Baiken.
He went over their instructions again. They listened in silence, nodding occasionally. Then, at a signal, they scurried into the fog to take up positions along the road. At the end of the bridge, they passed a milestone saying, 6,000 yards to the inner shrine. When the bridge was empty again, a great company of monkeys emerged from hiding, jumping from limbs, climbing vines, converging on the road. They ran out onto the bridge, crawled under it, threw stones into the ravine. The fog toyed with them, as if encouraging their frolic. Had a Taoist immortal appeared and beckoned, perhaps they would have been transformed into clouds and flown off with him to heaven. The barking of a dog echoed through the mountains. The monkeys vanished, like sumac leaves before an autumn wind. Kuro came up the road, dragging Oko along with him. He'd somehow broken loose, and though Oko had eventually got hold of the leash, she hadn't been able to make him go back. She knew Toji didn't want the dog around to make noise, so she thought maybe she could get him out of the way by letting him go up to the inner shrine. As the restlessly shifting fog began to settle in the valleys like snow, the three peaks of Mitsumine and the lesser mountains between Musashino and Kai rose against the sky in all their grandeur. The winding roads stood out white, and birds began to ruffle their feathers and chirp a greeting to the dawn. Iori said, half to himself, "Why is that, I wonder?"
"Why is what?" asked Musashi.
"It's getting light, but I can't see the sun."
"For one thing, you're looking toward the west."
"Oh!"
Iori gave the moon, sinking behind the distant peaks, a cursory glance.
"Iori, a lot of your friends seem to live here in the mountains."
"Where?"
"Over there."
Musashi laughed and pointed to some monkeys clustered around their mother.
I wish I was one of them.
Why?
At least they have a mother.
They climbed the steep part of the road in silence and came to a relatively flat stretch. Musashi noticed the grass had been trampled by a large number of feet. After winding around the mountain for a while more, they reached a level area where they were facing east.
Look! Cried Iori, looking over his shoulder at Musashi. The sun's coming up!
So it is. From the sea of clouds beneath them, the mountains of Kai and Kozuke jutted up like islands. Iori stopped and stood stock still, feet together, arms at his sides, lips tightly set. He stared in rapt fascination at the great golden sphere, imagining himself to be a child of the sun. All at once, he exclaimed in a very loud voice,
It's Amaterasu Omikami, isn't it?
He looked to Musashi for confirmation.
That's right.
Raising his arms high above his head, the boy filtered the brilliant light through his fingers.
My blood! He cried. It's the same color as the sun's blood!
Clapping his hands, as he would at a shrine to summon the deity, he bowed his head in silent obeisance, thinking,
The monkeys have a mother, I have none, but I have this goddess. They have none.
The revelation filled him with joy, and as he burst into tears, he seemed to hear from beyond the clouds the music of the shrine dances. The drums boomed in his ears, while the counterpoint of the flutes hovered around the melody of the dance of Iwato. His feet caught the rhythm, his arms swayed gracefully. From his lips came the words he had memorized only the night before.
The catalpa bough, with each coming of spring, I hope to see the dancing of the myriad of gods. Oh, how I hope to see their dancing!
Suddenly realizing Musashi had gone on ahead, he abandoned his dance and ran to catch up. The morning light barely penetrated the forest they now entered. Here, in the approach to the inner shrine, the cryptomerias were of enormous circumference and all about the same height. Tiny white flowers grew in the thick patches of moss clinging to the trees. Suspecting the trees were ancient, 500 years old, perhaps even 1,000, Iori had an urge to bow to them. Here and there, bright red vine maple caught his eye. Low-striped bamboo encroaching on the road narrowed it to a path. Without warning, the earth seemed to tremble under their feet. Close upon the thunderous report came an unnerving scream and a cascade of sharp echoes. Iori covered his ears with his hands and dived into the bamboo.
Iori, stay down,
Musashi commanded from the shadow of a large tree. Don't move, even if they trample on you. The gloomy half-light seemed infested with lances and swords. Because of the scream, the attackers thought at first the bullet had found its mark, but there was no body in sight. Uncertain as to what had happened, they froze. Iori was at the center of a circle of eyes and unsheathed blades. In the deathly silence that followed, curiosity got the better of him. He slowly raised his head above the bamboo. Only a few feet away, a sword blade, extending from behind a tree, caught a flash of sunlight. Losing all control, Iori screamed at the top of his lungs,
Sensei! Somebody's hiding there!
As he shouted, he jumped to his feet and made a dash for safety. The sword leapt from the shadows and hung like a demon above his head, but only for an instant. Musashi's dagger flew straight to the swordsman's head and lodged in the temple.
Yeah!
One of the priests charged at Musashi with his lance. Musashi caught the lance and held it tightly with one hand. Another death cry sounded, as if the man's mouth were full of rocks. Wondering if his attackers could be fighting among themselves, Musashi strained his eyes to see. The other priest took careful aim with his lance and hurtled toward him. Musashi caught this lance too and held it securely under his right arm.
Jump him now!
Screamed one of the priests, realizing that Musashi had his hands full.
His voice stentorian, Musashi shouted, "Who are you? Identify yourselves, or I'll assume you're all enemies. It's a shame to spill blood on this holy ground, but I may have no choice." Whirling the lances around and sending the two priests off on different tangents, Musashi whipped out his sword and finished off one of them before he had stopped tumbling. Spinning around, he found himself confronting three more blades, lined up across the narrow path. Without pausing, he moved toward them threateningly, one step at a time. Two more men came out and took their places shoulder to shoulder beside the first three. As Musashi advanced and his opponents retreated, he caught a glimpse of the other lancer priest, who had recovered his weapon and was chasing Iori.
"Stop, you cutthroat!"
But the moment Musashi turned to go to Iori's rescue, the five men let out a howl and charged. Musashi rushed head-on to meet them. It was like the collision of two raging waves, but the spray was blood, not brine. Musashi kept whirling from opponent to opponent with the speed of a typhoon. Two blood-curdling cries, then a third. They fell like dead trees, each sliced through the middle of the torso. In Musashi's right hand was his long sword, in his left, the short one. With cries of terror, the last two turned and ran, Musashi close behind them.
"Where do you think you're going?"
he shouted, splitting one man's head open with the short sword. The black spurt of blood caught Musashi in the eye. Reflexively, he raised his left hand to his face and, in that instant, heard a strange metallic sound behind him. He swung his long sword to deflect the object, but the effect of the action was very different from the intention. Seeing the ball and chain wrapped around the blade near the sword guard, he was seized with alarm. Musashi had been taken off guard.
"Musashi!"
shouted Baiken. He pulled the chain taut.
"Have you forgotten me?"
Musashi stared for a moment before exclaiming,
"Shishido Baiken, from Mount Suzuka." "That's right. My brother Tenma's calling you from the Valley of Hell. I'll see that you get there quick."
Musashi could not free his sword. By slow degrees, Baiken was taking in the chain and moving closer to make use of the razor-sharp sickle. As Musashi looked for an opening for his short sword, he realized with a start that if he had been fighting with only his long sword, he would be utterly defenseless now. Baiken's neck was so swollen it was nearly as thick as his head. With a strained cry, he jerked powerfully on the chain. Musashi had blundered. He knew that. The ball-chain sickle was an unusual weapon, but not unfamiliar to him. Years earlier, he had been struck by admiration when he had first seen the hellish device in the hands of Baiken's wife. But it was one thing to have seen it, something else to know how to counter it. Baiken gloated, a broad, evil grin spreading over his face. Musashi knew there was only one course open to him. He had to let go of his long sword. He looked for the right moment. With a ferocious howl, Baiken leapt and swept the sickle toward Musashi's head, missing by only a hair's breadth. Musashi released the sword with a loud grunt. No sooner had the sickle been withdrawn than the ball came whirling through the air. Then the sickle, the ball, the sickle. Dodging the sickle put Musashi right in the path of the ball. Unable to get close enough to strike, he wondered frantically how long he could keep it up.
"Is this it?"
he asked. The question was conscious, but as the tension increased, his body became difficult to control and his responses purely physiological. Not only his muscles, but his very skin was struggling instinctively. Concentration became so intense the flow of oily sweat stopped. Every hair on his body stood on end. It was too late to get behind a tree. If he made a dash for it now, he'd probably run into another foe. He heard a clear, plaintive cry and thought, "Uh-oh, Iori?" He wanted to look, but in his heart gave the boy up for lost.
"Die, you son of a bitch!"
The cry came from behind Musashi. Then,
"Musashi, why are you taking so much time? I'm taking care of the vermin behind you."
Musashi didn't recognize the voice, but decided he could focus his attention on Baiken alone. To Baiken, the most important factor was his distance from his opponent. His effectiveness depended on manipulating the length of chain. If Musashi could move a foot beyond the reach of the chain or approach a foot nearer, Baiken would be in trouble. He had to make sure that Musashi did neither. Musashi marveled at the man.